Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Seriously, the podcast from the New Statesman that takes pop culture seriously.
I'm Caroline Crampton.
And I'm Anna Leskovich. This week, we're going to be talking about Harry Styles' debut album and the Netflix adaptation of Anne of Green Gables.
We've also read Olivia Sudchik's novel Sympathy, so we'll be talking about how that went later in the show.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome back to another episode of Seriously. So thanks so much, everyone who made it down to our Twin Peaks quiz a week ago.
It was fantastic. Yeah, it was really, really good.
Highlights include Caroline's homemade cherry pie.
Yeah, the winning team seemed pretty pleased with that, even though they ate it all. It was kind of an improvised thing because it turns out really hard to buy cherry pie in the UK. I went to a lot of shops and you could get apple pie and like cherry crumble, but not cherry pie.
Yeah, well, the winning team did eat the whole pie, so I assume it was pretty good. And yeah, it was great fun. Do keep coming to our quizzes because they're literally some of the highlights of my social calendar.
Yeah, we're going to have another one in 2 months' time. So yeah, stay tuned and
watch this space.
Shortly be announcing what the theme for that will be. There's been a bit of good news picking up on something that we talked about on the podcast 2 weeks ago, I want to say, which is The Handmaid's Tale now has a UK distributor. It's going to be on Channel 4. Everyone who had been jealously watching people on social media in America talk about it will now be able to watch it for themselves. We also had a very funny reference in an email from Thomas, who said, I am loving The Handmaid's Tale, even if it is getting very tiring and costly flying to America each week to watch it.
Love that. So good. So I wanted to mention Master of None again, which we talked about last week, because I like raced through the rest of Master of None in the past week. And I was like mildly positive about it, I think, last week. And now I'm like, oh my God, it was a complete triumph.
Okay.
The episodes get like weirder and more confident as it goes on. You get quite a few episodes that sort of stay away from Dev and Dev's storyline and are actually just about like random people or like his friends or some like minor characters, which are really, really cool. And then the final two episodes of the series are like amazing and cinematic and like really emotional. And I was like completely in love with those.
This sounds so interesting. I haven't had the chance to watch any more of it, although I am intending to. That's so interesting given that. Do the episodes still stay at their short length of like 20, 25 minutes each?
Pretty much, but then the penultimate episode I think is almost an hour and a half.
Oh wow, okay.
And it is like a movie. I know that's always like a cheap line that people say about TV to try and like make it seem more prestigious when actually why should it be any less prestigious? But there's just something about the narrative of it that really pulls you in like a big vintage romance movie. It's great.
Oh, this sounds incredible. Can't wait.
Yeah. So, should we roll on with the show?
Yeah, let's get going because we have something very exciting to talk about next,
very,
right?
Very important, big cultural milestone this week, ladies and gents. So, the first thing we're going to talk about is, of course, Harry Styles. On Friday, 12th of May, 2017, the former One Direction star Harry Styles released his first solo album, titled simply Harry Styles. It's 10 classic rock-influenced tracks, clock in at just over 40 minutes. And it's gone with all this sort of like pink branding. And it's just, yeah, really exciting to finally get his debut album for me.
And you had a very exciting Harry Styles weekend as well, which I think you should tell us about.
A Harry Styles packed week. So shall I just go in from the top? So on Thursday night, I went to a screening of an Apple Music documentary made about Harry Styles making this album called Harry Styles : behind the album. I went with a friend who's also a music journalist, and we sort of like tottered up to this Notting Hill cinema, had to queue, there was loads of security. We took some photos with like the big billboards of Harry's face and stuff like that, went in. There were lots of fans there, fans who I have like seen around at One Direction things in the past. They were like, oh, there might be a message from Harry. We were like knocking our champagne back, like whatever, play the message. And then he just came into the room. Like, no joke. There was like 40 of us in the tiny cinema. And Harry Styles just like walked out in front of us. And me and my friend like couldn't go. We were like, oh my God, that's him in his like human corporeal form. And then he like introduced the doc a bit. And then he just stayed to watch the doc with us. So I was sort of doing this weird thing where I had like one eye on the documentary and the other eye on like human being Harry Styles, which was very difficult for me to comprehend, as I'm sure you can imagine.
I had a very strange, but and not in any way equivalent experience when I went to see...
I'm like trying to think who it's going to be. Who's the character?
Well, so I don't care about this person, but the same like weird, like half your brain on one thing. When I went to see Andrew O'Hagan read his very, very long essay about his involvement with Julian Assange and WikiLeaks.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And randomly, just before he started, Benedict Cumberbatch like came out of a side door and sat right in the middle row, like literally in front of me, right in front of Andrew O'Hagan. And afterwards, apparently someone told me that he was researching his role in that terrible film, Julian Assange, and that's why he was there. But the whole time I was like, A, why is he there? B, the back of his neck is really strange looking. And see, I now can't concentrate on this lecture because like actual Sherlock is sitting right in front of me.
Yeah, the only equivalent that I have for this kind of thing is like going to plays, opening nights, press nights of plays where like friends and family of the actors come along and then like other actors they know and that kind of thing. But yeah, so that was super weird. And then I like tried to keep my cool throughout that. Then the next day, let it be known that I work very hard at my job, okay, everyone, before I admit this. I snuck out of work at like 5:45. Left a full 15 minutes early and went and stood outside BBC broadcasting house and watched Harry Styles perform Sweet Creature, one of the songs off his new album, outside of The One Show, because he was on The One Show, which again, a lot of the same faces that I've seen around a lot and like everyone having a great time. The atmosphere is always amazing at these things. So that was really fun. And then on Saturday night, the real like crown jewel of my three consecutive seeing Harry Styles in person days this week, it was his first solo gig, which was at the Garage in Highbury in Islington. And I think they sold something like 200 tickets. Friend of the show, Laura Snapes, who we've mentioned a few times, who's a great writer.
She was on our Gilmore Girls special.
She was on our Gilmore Girls special. And yeah, we love her work. She was going as a journalist and she refused her place so that they would let me go. Isn't that the nicest thing you've ever heard?
Yes.
Doesn't it just bring a tear to your
That's
eye?
That's like the modern equivalent of someone like lying down in a puddle so that you can cross.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was very, very heartwarmed. And then we were kind of hoping she would get in, but she didn't. So that was kind of sad. But yeah, the gig itself was amazing. I feel like I like the album. It's probably not an album that I would be like super excited about if it was by somebody else, but I do really like it. But seeing it live was like a whole nother thing. It just worked so amazingly well live. His charisma is obviously so important to who he is as like a brand, and that just really like spilled forth in the most like incredible way. And then he also did a Kanye West cover. I love Kanye West. That was kind of weird. He did like a very slow down ultralight beam thing.
Ah, interesting.
And my personal highlight of the night, he covered Stockholm Syndrome. Didn't cover it because he kind of wrote it. It's a One Direction song that he has a writing credit on. Like some other journalist that I was with started to be like, she's a bit of a fangirl. And I was like, hey, I'm right here. He was like, I'm just saying you're a fangirl, aren't you? And I was like, yeah, fair. But yeah, I had a great time. So that was amazing. And I've like got now this like enormous pink Harry Styles poster in my bedroom that they were giving out on the door of the gig. So what a whirlwind 3 days. I feel like your experience has probably mainly been listening to the album.
Yes, I just listened to the album on repeat for a 4-hour train journey.
What do you reckon?
And I really, really like it.
Yeah, I find it really enjoyable.
Yeah, it's not at all what I think I was expecting. I mean, I had a bit of a hint after Sign of the Times came out, and Sign of the Times was this kind of 7-minute rock infused ballad about the apocalypse. And I was like, ah, interesting, Harry. Where are you going with this?
Yeah.
And yeah, where he's going with this is this very kind of bluesy rock tinged, slightly slower pop style. Lots of quite raw emotional vocals, lots of interesting instruments. So some, it's obviously a very well produced album, but they've left some of the guitar sounds and stuff quite raw. So it does occasionally sound like, you know, something you'd hear in a small venue from a small new band, as opposed to like one of the world's biggest pop stars.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a really, really nice aesthetic, and one that I can, yeah, see myself enjoying for many years to come. It's interesting that his solo debut has slightly coincided with the return of Miley Cyrus, another kind of young pop idol. But the difference could not be more obvious, because she's someone who sheds musical personas like a snake's shed skin.
Definitely.
None of them feel serious or really invested for her, because she just, you know, becomes a new style and a new thing
like
for each album.
Putting on a wig or whatever, yeah.
Putting on a wig, becoming country, becoming hip-hop, whatever. Whereas I really hope, and I do believe that this is sincere from Harry Styles, that this is the music that he wants to make right now.
Exactly. I so agree. And like, some of it I find embarrassing. You know, like sometimes you can tell that this is like, these are the lyrics written by a kind of like horny 23-year-old rather than like, you know, a polished like 47-year-old professional songwriter who's trying to get inside the head of like teenagers, which is essentially what a lot of One Direction lyrics were. Instead, you get these kind of like weird lyrics about like masturbating, or like sometimes like vaguely misogynistic lyrics about women, and it's all a bit like, ooh, Harry, this is a little piece of you that we just weren't really getting before. And I do think one thing you can say about the lyrics is that all these songs are very catchy, and you do feel like you've heard them before, or like you know the words quite quickly. And I think that probably comes out of the fact that he said a few times he just wrote them really fast and like didn't play around with them very much, so they've got that instinctive element. Whether you like think they're like amazing poetry or not, at least you can tell that they're like pretty fucking genuine.
Yeah, so I don't think he's going to win any prizes for writing lyrics right now, but I just keep coming back to his voice. His voice is amazing.
It's absolutely amazing.
And I didn't expect it.
And he's got so much personality in his voice, and a lot of his charisma I think comes through in his singing voice, and it's just really good. Like, it is just a really good singing voice.
And we should talk a bit about the narrative that surrounded the release of this album, which is former boy band star sheds bubblegum pop for serious rock influence. And you've written quite a lot about how this is just total baloney.
Well, I think if you're a super like diehard One Direction fan, you know that the last couple of One Direction albums sounded not hugely dissimilar to this. Like, this is still a bit more, it's a lot more ragged around the edges and like playful. And it's not as structured as like One Direction music is. But One Direction music was still very guitar influenced. Like, I read a piece by Peter from Pop Justice, who said recently that the very first note of the very first One Direction single came on a guitar. And that was sort of their thing from the beginning, was like, here's a boy band, but it's guitar music. I don't think it's like necessarily 100% accurate to say, oh yeah, this like bubblegum teen pop band suddenly, he's now leaving that behind to like play guitars and like sing about like raunchy things, because raunchy lyrics and guitar music were like two of the main hallmarks of those later One Direction albums for me.
And Harry Styles himself has refuted this narrative by basically saying that what I'm doing now grew out of what I did then. And he had this amazing paragraph in a Rolling Stone interview where he was saying, like, you know, the fans that I have for One Direction are the fans I love and the fans that I respect and will continue to have.
Absolutely. And that really warms my heart, because I mean, this is like a kind of weird diversion-y thing to say, but I have been a super fan of like different male celebrities, and then at some point they let you down, right? We've all been there. I don't feel like I even need to name specific names, but you worry sometimes about that when you're like a fan of somebody, like, are they gonna let you down? But I think those Rolling Stone quotes and another quote in the documentary reminded me of how much I love Harry Styles fans. And that's so important to me, because there's this whole bit in the documentary where he talks about how being in One Direction was a great experience for him, and like, he doesn't feel like he was faking it. He like had a great time, and like, he doesn't think he should have to apologize for like coming from a boy band. And that was so important to all the fans in the room. They were like screaming, and I like shed a little tear, because I was like, oh, this is just a great fandom And that's what makes him a special artist for me, regardless of other things.
Mm. I also just wanted, before we wrap up on this, to call back to our very first episode.
Oh, yeah.
Of Seriously.
Where we talked about One Direction.
We talked about One Direction. And because before that, I was obviously aware of One Direction and had heard some of their songs because you couldn't be alive in Britain and you hadn't. But I'd never probably listened to them. And after our very first recommend, you made me a One Direction playlist.
I did.
Which I still listen to
sometimes.
It's
a great playlist.
It's a really great playlist.
Say.
We will reshare the link to that playlist because it is excellent.
Yeah.
And yeah, so the journey of Seriously for me has definitely been the journey of learning and loving One Direction.
Yeah, and One Direction have been actually a part of my life for a really long time, which like sounds stupid because I was like one of the older fans, I think probably when they first started to go big. But yeah, it feels like coming full circle to me to see Harry like talking about that experience and not being ashamed of it. It's really like cool.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Now we're going to talk about Anne with an E, which is a new Netflix adaptation of the 1908 novel Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery, which is about the life of Anne Shirley, a young red-headed orphan on Prince Edward Island in northeast Canada. This adaptation is written and produced by Moira Wally-Beckett, who worked on Breaking Bad, and stars Amy Beth McNulty, R.H. Thompson, and Geraldine James.
Yeah, so I am a Anne of Green Gables newcomer. I have never read that series of books, but I get the impression, and I'm sure you can clarify for me, that people who have grown up with it are really, really passionate about it.
Yes, I don't think it's anywhere near as big a fandom as Harry Potter, but I and people I know who read the books, when, especially girls when they were young, have an equivalent attachment to it as a canon, because there are 8-10 Anne books altogether. Mm. You know, you first meet her when she's, you know, 11 or 12, and you sort of see her all the way through growing up, going to college, getting married, having her own children. So you really feel invested in her life and her world.
In my head, they sort of exist in a like What Katie Did / Secret Garden / A Little Princess space. Is that kind of right? Because I loved all those books growing up.
Those were all the books I read at the same time.
Yeah.
So yeah, you definitely, in terms of stories about young women having adventures, etc., they all exist in the same space and are for roughly the same age group. I think maybe what sets Anne of Green Gables slightly apart from them is the setting. You know, they're set on Prince Edward Island, the early 20th century, which is it's one of the maritime provinces of Canada, so it's an island on its own. So like later in the series, when she goes to college, she has to go to college like on another island. Mm. And it's a really big deal for her not to, you know, be in the place where she's grown up and where she's, you know, finally had a loving family, etc.
Yeah, so this adaptation, is it faithful to what you remember for the book?
No, it's not at all. But then we weren't really expecting it to be. I'd kind of followed the news about this adaptation for a while. And basically, the writer had said very early on that she didn't want to try and make a faithful adaptation. A, because that's already been tried. These are books that have been adapted a lot. Mm. There's a very famous and very well-loved 1985 series of TV movies called Anne of Green Gables and then Anne of Avonlea that are a lot more faithful to the events of the book.
Right.
And everyone my age fancies Gilbert Blythe from that, you know. It was very much a cultural thing.
Mm.
And she sort of said that she wanted to try and do something different in a serialized form, hence not calling it Anne of Green Gables.
Yeah, that's a big like tip off, isn't it?
Yeah, so there's a strand of canonical plot events in this, from the really basic ones of the names of the characters and the setting to the fact that, you know, Anne is an orphan who's being adopted by an older brother and sister. The confusion about them wanting to adopt a boy and then a girl turning up, that's all in the books. I've watched 5 of the 7 episodes now. Various of the events as you go along, often the more minor events, are taken from the book.
Mm.
But the bigger plot arcs are new.
Right. So that first episode is the only one I've seen, which for me was very much just setting the scene in terms of what to expect from the rest of this season. It's just all about whether or not this brother and sister, as you say, are going to adopt her when there's been this confusion about them wanting a boy and etc. And when she's sort of a little larger than life than they perhaps expected. Obviously, if you know that this is an adaptation of Anne of Green Gables, you know that that's all going to be fine. So the stakes are very low in that episode, but it's more, I guess, about giving you a sense of like her background. There's like quite a lot of flashbacks. I don't know if that is like grimmer than the books.
Much more. So a lot of the commentary about this series, and it's been, from what I can tell, quite positively reviewed, has been it's essentially Anne of Green Gables, but with PTSD.
Mm.
Because although there are descriptions in the book and hints at how horrible her life was before she came to Green Gables, there's no extended description. And I think after the first book, essentially, you don't really hear much about it.
Mm.
So the fact that they've chosen to kind of incorporate that more strongly into her character and actually show you flashbacks to like the actual abuse that she suffered in her previous foster homes and stuff is quite a big departure.
Yeah.
But I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, I think it works. Because I also think there's something difficult with these particular sorts of characters. So Anne is a bookworm, imaginative, chatty, precocious, huge vocabulary, over-intelligent kid. And tomboyish. I think that is a character that we see in so many young adult books, especially maybe sort of older ones. Like, she seems like a Jo from Little Women sort of figure.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
I know that if I'd read these books as a young kid, I would have identified with her and loved her and just like been like, oh, this is me, in that sort of almost arrogance of like being a kid and seeing yourself on the page. But as an adult to watch, very annoying.
Yeah.
So I think it's really good that they incorporate this, like, this is a girl who's like had really terrible hardships, so you're not just sat there like, oh my god, will she shut up, she's so annoying.
Yeah, exactly. And they've also, I feel like, amplified more of the community discussion about what it means for her to be an orphan.
Definitely.
And what it means for a childless woman and her brother to adopt an orphan. So there's, for instance, in a later episode, Marilla, who's a new mum, gets invited by some of the younger mums in the village to go to their progressive parenting group, where they're all the mothers of daughters, and they're discussing how, you know, they want their daughters to go to university and all of this kind of stuff. And then Anne goes for her first day at school, and she, without knowing it, she makes a kind of faux pas in that there's some sort of discussion of like, what is sex, etc. And Anne just like explains it to them because she's had a really difficult life. Mm. She's seen some stuff and she tells them about it in fairly horrible terms. And all the other mothers in the group then ban Marilla from coming because they're like, your daughter, you know, she's a dirty mouth. She can't, she's not acceptable. She'll pollute them. This kind of thing. And Marilla gets furious. Mm. And so all of that, none of that's in the book. But it's all completely, to me anyway, plausible within the framework of the book. It's just exploring, as you say, issues that the adult viewer or reader would want to see that definitely children don't really care about.
So it's still, in your mind, sort of true to the spirit of the novels.
Yeah.
It's just taking it up a notch for a kind of slightly older audience.
I have seen some spoilery discussion of something that happens later on in the series that some fans feel very strongly is out of character.
For Anne.
No, for Matthew, for her new dad.
Mm.
But I haven't seen that yet, so I'm not going to comment on it. But there was a fairly furious piece published on Vogue.com.
Oh,
it was
really?
Basically saying Matthew would never behave like this.
Oh my
this.
God, splits in the Anne of Green Gables fandom. So I live for it.
So it's not in any way receiving a kind of universal approval from super fans. But all I can say is, so far, personally, I feel like the writer is making the characters behave in the way that they would, even if the events she's portraying were not in the books.
Okay, cool. Well, maybe we'll come back to it next week if you see it and have like a sudden change of heart.
Yes.
So last week we agreed we'd look at Sympathy by Olivia Sudjic, which is a debut novel, and it's all about sort of basically becoming obsessed with someone via Instagram and then trying to be friends with them in real life.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'd say that's an accurate summary. It's such an intense novel. Like, reading it is I found a really immersive and almost quite feverish experience.
It definitely opens in that vein, doesn't it? It sort of opens with a description of Alice, the lead character, almost, yeah, like in a sweat, unfollowing this girl on Instagram, or she has recently unfollowed this girl on Instagram, and she's like trying to decide whether to like request to refollow or not, or whether that's like too humiliating.
And she discusses how when she does request to refollow, the object of her desire has changed her privacy settings, and so she has to wait, and she describes the white wall on her phone, the barrier between her and all of the pictures that she wants to be able to see.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's quite easy when we're describing this book, if you've not read any of it, to imagine in your head a sort of quite like fun, very accessible piece of writing. And it's very literary, right?
It's very literary. Actually, what it reminded me of most was The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt.
Oh, I haven't read that. And everyone's always telling me to read it. I've got to read it.
Which I don't think is anywhere near as amazing as everyone says.
Right.
But I found it to be a very enjoyable page turner. Like,
yeah.
I raced through it on holiday. But it is very much, I don't know, there are so many parallels with it. It's a lot longer than Sympathy, and it has a lot more locations and scenes. But the section that this reminded me so much of is the first section in New York, where the protagonist is, just to give you a very, very brief summary, he goes to the Met with his mum, and then there's a terrorist attack, and the bit of the museum he's in is blown up, and his mum is killed, and he ends up living this kind of slightly wandering life. But he's obsessed with beautiful objects. The Goldfinch is a painting that he sees in the museum. And he, in the course of this accident, he meets this girl and her sort of older protector, friend of the family, and basically becomes obsessed with this girl. And the whole rest of the book is about how he's convinced that if he can only make himself worthy of the beautiful objects, he'll be worthy of her too.
Mm.
And I felt very strongly, both in its setting in New York and its sort of literariness, and also in its kind of obsession with an unobtainable individual.
Yeah.
That this was like that.
Well, I also was quite struck by the kind of like fetishistic aspects of it, where it's like, oh, she reads Joan Didion and she wears culottes and mules and all these things that are just so what kind of trendy women online do. Mm. It's very aware of those trends and those like societal norms, basically, especially for like, you know, self-defining intelligent as well as trendy young women. We've talked about Joan Didion and her like relationship with millennial women quite a lot on Seriously, and reference that Hayley Low-Tech piece that was really good from The Hairpin. So there's a lot of that in there. For me, the best bits of this book, and also almost the worst bits of this book, are the bits that are actually about the experience of being online, because
yes, exactly,
you just connect with them so much because they're so relatable, especially about the like all the kind of like negative feelings that can be involved in like stalking someone online.
Yeah, there was this one line that she, I think it comes fairly early on when she's, Alice is talking about when she actually first met Mizuko, and she says, she didn't know me at all, and that felt unreasonable and surprising.
Yeah.
And that's so representative of the imbalance of information you get when you've been so invested in someone online, because you know everything about them, or at least you think you do. You know everything about what they've put out on social media. And then if you do ever actually meet them in person, it's a very weird dynamic to have them say, oh yeah, I went on holiday there, and for you to just say, I know.
Yeah, exactly. How do you begin to navigate that? There's a bit where she says something like, I already knew what all her favourite things were and all her favourite places, so I mentioned them first.
Mm.
Which is like such a weird way to sort of like convince someone that you have stuff in common, but also something I think almost everyone I know has probably done at some point. So,
or even, I mean, I find myself doing this in a much more low-level way with like journalists who I sort of consider to be colleagues at other publications, don't really know them that well, but I spend all day on Twitter sort of with them. If you actually meet up with them in real life, I find myself pretending that I don't know about
that
stuff.
I haven't read things that they've written.
So that they can tell me about it, so as not to like nuke normal social interaction.
Yeah, you don't want to burst the bubble too much. And there are some things, yeah, there's like, I thought she was quite good on the way that, and this isn't something that's necessarily particularly pertinent to like the last 10 years, but the way in which images and photographs can alter your memory. So there's a bit where she's like, when I try and remember what Mizuko looked like without using pictures for references, I try and think about her outline first, and then I move inwards and try and think about her jewellery or her silhouette and stuff like that. And those sort of mind tricks you play on yourself. But for me, sometimes this did fall into kind of like traps of like online bad.
Yes.
There'll be moments where she says like posting pictures on Instagram was like bursting bubble wrap or pulling out a hair follicle, and you're like, okay, cool, that's like what a lot of people might say. But then it kind of goes up a notch into, there's almost no positive things that come out of this character's relationship with the internet and with other people through the internet.
Yeah, I was quite disappointed by that, because I feel like Jonathan Franzen has very much set the tone for literary New York-y novels as having to be, place themselves in opposition to the internet and to online life. And I was sort of hoping that, especially because this book is getting quite a lot of critical acclaim and the author's debut has been very anticipated and stuff, that she was going to be able to change that conversation and be like, no, look, I've written a really literary New York novel that concludes that the internet's just a fact of life and narratives can be shaped around it. They don't have to be good or bad, but that's not really what this is.
Yeah, and there's sort of a vague idea that like the connections you make online are always fundamentally fake because they're so curated.
Mm.
And it is true that a lot of them are very curated in some ways, but I've also made like human friends via the internet that I will now see in person and have a great time with and feel that I have a very genuine connection with. And there's a line about the grandmother of the main character pulls out a box of stuff that's her parents' stuff, and she's going through this physical box of stuff and finds it so personal that she becomes almost repulsed and overwhelmed. And I think it's meant to be some sort of comment on how she's very used to stalking but not actually used to anything personal or really representative of a person. And there's a bit in the like blurb of the book, the author sort of sums up the book, and she says, like my protagonist Alice, I'm on the cusp of a generation that appears increasingly disconnected from reality, locked into our fantasy lives, filter bubbles and secret algorithms, living in an era that is post-truth while deluding ourselves that we are connecting, controlling, choosing. Which for me is very black and white negative.
Mm.
in a way that I sort of wasn't expecting this book to be, because it is kind of pulling you in even with its cover and with its subject matter about saying, like, this is about your life, your online life. And I'm like, yeah, it kind of is, but also I have a lot of like positive relationships.
Yes.
But I'm into like obsession and stalking and these kinds of themes. And I feel like we talk about them quite a lot on Seriously. So there was a lot in there that I really enjoyed as well.
Yeah. So if any Seriously listeners are reading this book, we would be so interested to hear your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
As citizens of the internet, what do you think?
So what are we going to do next week, Caroline?
Well, I thought we might not relinquish our Twin Peaks related obsessions quite yet. The quiz is over. Our excessive binge watching of the show in order to write the quiz is complete. But we can still spend a bit more time with David Lynch before the new series comes out.
Okay.
In the form of his 2001 film Mulholland Drive.
Oh, I've never seen this movie and I hear so much about it all the time.
So I saw it for the first time last Sunday. Loads of cinemas in London, and I'm sure all over the place, have been screening it. I think because the third series of Twin Peaks does start really soon, and Mulholland Drive gets described a lot as a neo-noir film. Mm. And so I think it's kind of in roughly the same zone as Twin Peaks, yeah. Although made, you know, 10, 11 years later. I don't want to tell you too much about it because I think you should just go in knowing nothing.
But I love to do that with stuff.
But it stars Naomi Watts and a load of other people. And it's very strange. That's all I'm going to say. It's very, very strange.
Very strange.
I was expecting
it to be very normal and mainstream. Yeah.
As you would expect from a film with that title, it's a film about Hollywood.
Yeah.
And cinema and films and the kind of horrible, twisted things that can happen.
So I'm expecting a La La Land style romp.
Yeah, it's probably, I think somewhere wrote, or maybe I made this up in my head,
maybe
I can't remember.
It.
It's basically like La La Land through a glass darkly, if you know what I mean. It's
okay.
Like the dark timeline version
I love
of La
it.
La Land.
I'm so there. Thanks for listening to this episode of Seriously, the pop culture podcast from The New Statesman.
If you enjoyed the show, why not subscribe to make sure you never miss another episode? We're available in all the usual places you get podcasts, including iTunes, where you could also leave us a review if you'd like.
At our website, seriouslypod.com, you can find all our back episodes, plus our specials on Home Alone, Gilmore Girls, Harry Potter, Love Actually, and Friends.
We're available many other places on the internet, including on Twitter, Facebook, and Tumblr. We're seriouslypod on all of them.
We love getting your recommendations for things we should feature on the show, or just hearing your thoughts on what we've discussed. Get in touch on social media or email us at seriouslypod@gmail.com.
And if you feel strongly that more pop culture needs to be taken seriously, spread the word and tell your friends and family about the podcast.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.